Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for June the 3rd, 2019. This is David Corey along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thank you for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hey there, David, and good evening, everybody. Tonight we have another fast hour of information and news of interest to veterans. But before jumping into our show tonight, I'd like to once again acknowledge two sponsors of our show. The ever-loving Joyce and Joe Chivaroli, whose financial contribution helps us provide this weekly show for the benefit of veterans and their families across the country. We have a special guest tonight, Lauren Price. She returns to the Veterans News Hour. Always glad to have Lauren on the show. She's with the Veteran Warriors, and she's going to discuss the issue of toxic contamination from open-air burn pits used by the military in Iraq and Afghanistan during those wars, and how so many veterans have been affected with cancer and various other illnesses, as well as legislation pending and other things involving the DOD. So, you know, Lauren's going to have a lot to say. I do want to remind everybody that this is a call-in show. We welcome your views, your comments, your questions. If you have a question for Lauren Price, please call. You can call us anytime during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, that number is 1-888-627-6008. If for any reason you missed that during the show, we will give that number out again. Now, without further ado, David, back to you.
Thank you, Richard. And let me introduce our special guest. Lauren Price is the founder of Veteran Warriors, a national veterans advocacy group, and she has led that organization since its creation in 2009. She's testified before Congress on many veteran issues. As far as career training and experience, she graduated from Omega Institute in New Jersey with a paralegal certification in 1987. She also has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice with a minor in psychology from St. Leo University. She has nearly two decades of experience in the legal profession, and of particular significance to our discussion tonight on this show, she served in the United States Navy for a decade between January 2005 and January 2015. Including serving for more than a year in Iraq as a convoy driver as well as a public affairs officer in Baghdad. She also served as the Intel and Logistics Lead Petty Officer at the Defense Logistics Agency, United States Central Command. She co-founded the veterans group called Veteran Warriors with her husband, Jim Price, who is a retired Navy Senior Chief. Military service is a proud tradition in her family, with four of her five sons having served in the military as well. She's our special guest tonight on the Veterans News Hour to talk about some issues of great importance to thousands of veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan war. So without further ado, I welcome Lauren Price to the Veterans News Hour. How are you tonight, Lauren?
I'm just fine, thank you. Thank you very much, David and Rick, for having me back on the show. Got big doings now about toxic exposures, and I'm very excited to share the latest updates with you and your listeners.
Well, thank you, Lauren. Yeah, we're looking forward to hearing the latest news, and you're an expert in this field, so I hope our listeners are taking notes. We have a lot to talk about, but for the benefit of our listeners, perhaps those that might have not heard you on some of your previous appearances on our show, why don't you begin by telling us a bit about your experience in the Navy, including your service of more than 1 year in Iraq. What was that like? What was your own personal experience with the open burn pit issue?
Well, like most people, went to Iraq, and it was at the height of the war. We were there, we got there early 2007 and left in the spring of 2008. And because I was in two positions, my primary role as a convoy driver and the secondary role as the public affairs officer, I was in and amongst everything. The whole eastern third of Iraq belonged to us. We were civil affairs. So we were on the ground, and we were all up and down the whole eastern third of Iraq, and got to see and be exposed to literally everything. we were stationed on, it's known as Victory Base Complex, was a consortium of what was originally over 30 different small FOBs all around Baghdad International Airport. And I was on Camp Liberty. I was a quarter of a mile from what's laughingly known as Camp Trash Can. And it was as large, if not larger, than the one that everyone knows about, which was at Balad. Our pit ran 24/7. Everything, and I do mean everything, that we had to be disposed of went in that pit. And most of us, you know, have, even people that aren't exposed to the military, have heard the term the Iraqi crud. And it's a upper respiratory infection that a lot of people get when they're over there. And in my case, my entire convoy team came down with it, and we were all sick for about a week. And I never completely got over it. And by the time I got home, and bearing in mind, I was an athlete all my life. The day before I left for Iraq, I did my PT run in 12 minutes, 20 seconds. I never had a problem running. I never had a problem with stamina or anything else. By the time I got home, I couldn't climb 2 flights of stairs.
Wow.
Was getting sicker and sicker. And finally, after I came home and got into the command at Central Command, I was being treated actually out in the civilian world because of the military has taken away a lot of the specialty clinics. They don't have all of those at all facilities any longer. So I was being treated by civilian doctors.
And this was at MacDill Air Force Base? I mean, you were stationed at MacDill?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. And I ended up having to, and it was about 8 months after I got home, I had to have a lung biopsy done because the doctor could not figure out what was wrong and why increasing steroids and increasing all these other medications wasn't helping. And the thing that will stick with me forever was when I woke up in recovery and he told me, he said, "It looks like you inhaled Drano."
Wow.
He said, "Your lungs are so badly burned and scarred looking inside." He says, "I have nice color pictures for you, but," he said, "it really does look like you inhaled like some kind of caustic chemical." He said, "What were you breathing over there?" I said, "Well, literally just breathing every day." And over the course of time, and I won't belabor the point of, you know, how it has to go through the military process and the Department of Veterans Affairs, but I got to the point where I understood that there was going to be a huge disconnect between those of us coming home being sick and getting treatment, being diagnosed even, and then getting treatment if any was available, and also getting benefits and services that we were entitled to. And my husband and I, he was with me through this whole thing, and he got to see where all these breakdowns in the programs and various services were. And that's kind of what led us to starting Veteran Warriors. Since then, I've not just, my civilian career before I enlisted was as a paralegal. And paralegals are researchers. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. And here, you know, I get this weird disease, and I don't know what it is, so I dive in head first. And I don't, and I do, and I, please, people, do not use Google. I swear, don't do it. You know, WebMD is not your friend. But reaching out to researchers and reaching out to people who are handling this particular thing, and even people like the EPA, I was reaching out to OSHA. I needed information. And I finally found one of the three major doctors in the country that treats the condition that I have is Dr. Miller at Nashville. He's at Vanderbilt Medical Center. And he identified this disease specifically in 73 soldiers that were affected in Mosul, Iraq, which is in northern Iraq. Mm-hmm. And over the course of time, more and more of us have come to him, and he's finding more and more of us that have this. And the only conclusive way to diagnose this disease called constrictive bronchiolitis is through a lung biopsy. And I've heard from officials from the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs tell me, well, you know, there's other ways to determine it. No, that's wrong. There's no other way to conclusively determine if this person has constrictive bronchiolitis. you have to go because it's all the way down in the bottom of the lungs. It's in the small airways in the bottom.
And don't other tests seem to be silent on a diagnosis? Isn't that why what you were saying has to be done?
What we find is what's happened to all of this, almost to the man and woman. The VA and DOD, their standard for any lung ailment is to do pulmonary function testing. And then we've all seen those pictures. I actually have a good picture of me doing one. You breathe into this machine, and you have to breathe in a certain pattern, and it's supposed to gauge how much air volume you can take in, how much you can express. And that is the only test that they use for any reading determinations, whether it's through your med board or through the VA. And that's where they stop. They literally will go no further. Unless they see a huge glob or a spot in your lung or something, they won't do anything else. So to determine that you have CB, you have to get outside of those systems to find out that you have it. The problem with CB is it's terminal. There is no cure. You get worse, and you get worse, and eventually you just can't breathe anymore, and it's not a lack of oxygen. It's that your lungs can't process anything. They can't move. And that's what actually the doctor who originally found it, that's what he saw, is people are familiar with scarring from burns. It loses its elasticity, your skin or your muscle or whatever. Well, your lungs are just a muscle. And when they're damaged like this, they don't move anymore. And you eventually just suffocate. The other problem we've discovered is that there's a whole bunch of this huge host of other diseases. CB is still, even after 10 years of being home, CB is still one of the rarest diseases out there. There's probably about 1,000 of us that have it, that have been confirmed diagnosed. Mm-hmm. However, we're seeing astronomically and statistically impossible numbers of extremely rare cancers, cancers that are only genetically linked and that are showing up in people that have no genetic markers or linkage to them. People dying of, in 4 or 5 months from cancers that they should have never gotten. And now we're seeing this new thing of brain injuries that the one in particular, my personal favorite, is called white matter disease. It's when the white matter, which is what passes all the electrical signals to the different parts of the brain, it starts to rot away. And it basically, it's typical in Alzheimer's.
Wow.
And the problem is that they don't normally see that in someone in their 50s. And it's even way past early onset Alzheimer's. When they see it at someone at my age, they're like, holy moly, where did this come from? And there's a term being coined, but I've yet to define with anyone in the research world whether this is an actual medical term or a clinical term, is toxic brain injury. I know all of this because I was diagnosed with this in February. And I work with some of the leading researchers in the nation on these toxic exposures. And even they're saying the same thing, that we've not seen this before. It's not something that normally shows up.
Now you say
until
Dr.
You're
Miller
in your 80s.
Vanderbilt. Dr. Miller from Vanderbilt is one that seemed to be on the leading edge with the constrictive bronchiolitis. Can you share the names of some of the other experts, in case there are listeners out there that might find that helpful?
Absolutely. And in addition to giving them now, we have a resources page on our website where we've got all their information as well.
What's your website?
Anthony, it's veteranwarriorsadvocacy.com. It's a mouthful, but you'll find us.
Okay, veteranwarriorsadvocacy.com. Okay, and tell us more about these experts. You mentioned Dr. Miller, who's at Vanderbilt.
It's Dr. Robert Miller at Vanderbilt, and he's the leading guy that's defined and determined, but does these biopsies. There's Dr. Anthony Zima. His last name is S-Z, like zebra, I-M-A. He's at Stony Brook Medical Center in New York. He's more into an enormous amount of research into particulate matter, and is finding a lot of the heavy metals and finding them in people's bones and their blood and their teeth and things like this. And heavy metals, in case people don't understand, is things like like uranium is a heavy metal, and finding that in your bones is not good for humans, okay?
Right.
So that's what Dr. Zima does. And then there's Dr. Cecile Rose, and she's a Jewish national. She's actually been side by side with both of these gentlemen, but she's done some more broader things, not just focused on one particular disease.
What's her name again? What's her name again?
Cecile Rose.
Cecile Rose, okay.
Yeah, and she's at Jewish National. And then I will say...
that is where, in New York?
Jewish National, for some reason, I can look it up real quick.
Oh.
There are also, the V has what's called RISC, and that's W-R-I-I-S-C. And there are three RISC locations in the nation. The veteran has to be referred by their primary care, but no one can be denied to go. The veteran needs to ask. We obviously don't recommend it if you don't feel you have any symptomatic reason to go. And they will do an evaluation, especially if you're having symptoms of a bunch of different weird symptoms that can't get connected for anything, because that's how a lot of us find out we're sick.
I see.
The problem we're having is that because there's only three in the nation, the VA's been doing really the slow walk on treatment, on doing environmental exposure evaluations on veterans, never mind the whole claims process. You know, there's 100, you know, we're well over 175,000 on the registry, and we've got pretty solid numbers showing that there's probably at least double that, if not more, of those who either aren't on it. I'm not on it. I was actually one of the lobbyists that helped get it, but I'm not on it because I was already registered on Gulf War Registry.
Well, Lauren, let me just ask you to circle back for a second and tell us a little bit more about this this RISC process or program that you were mentioning, if you could.
RISC is an evaluation program, and they do, because I haven't gone through it, but I only know from all the people that we work with that have. They do this big evaluation, and it takes, on an average, of 5 to 7 working days of evaluating you, and it's all-day thing. You're there for a bazillion different kinds of tests. They go through all of your records, and they're not looking for a diagnosis. They are looking to identify all the things that are wrong, and we'll sort of let the diagnosis float to the top at the end of that. And I do know the one in Palo Alto, California, we have an enormous amount of our members are out in the West Coast and out into the Midwest or the Southwest, and they've been amazing. Those people in Palo Alto, one of our members on our team, her husband's going to the one in Washington, D.C. next week. So this will be the first time we get feedback on how Washington, D.C. is handled.
I see.
But afterwards, they do a lot of follow-up, and they do ongoing care and treatment for a variety of the things that are identified during those evaluations, whereas you don't go back into your regular VA doctor.
Let me ask you, have you heard if there's much bureaucratic resistance to a service member who has followed your advice, which is to ask for that evaluation? Is it a lot of roadblocks to getting that done, or what? Have you heard anything on that?
The thing we're seeing is predominantly the slow walk from providers who, I don't want to paint any brush with, you know, anybody with a brush, but there are some that, you know, they treat the veteran or their family member who's advocating for them, I'm the doctor, I know better than you. And
right.
That's not necessarily true. And especially when we're talking about some of the symptomatic things that happen with some of these very strange and rare diseases is they don't get connected. They're not the things that you normally will see walking in the door. So you have to do some deeper digging. And a lot of these doctors, especially the ones under the bureaucracy systems of the VA and the military, they're not there to cure you. They're not there to truly even care for you. They're there to process you through. Whether even the VA, it's not a huge warm and fuzzy. It's you come in, there's something wrong with you, you have a sore throat, oh, here's some antibiotics, here's some throat lozenges, go. And the digging and the investigating part is the difficult part, and finding empathetic, compassionate, and interested providers in any sector, whether it's through the government or as a civilian, is difficult. And the biggest problem we've had is that a lot of these two agencies, a lot of their providers are treating, we have one of two scenarios that usually happens, is they assume that the veteran and or their caregiver, family member, what have you, are they're exaggerating, or they're looking for problems where there aren't any. And the other side of it is the ones that assume that we're malingering, that we're just looking for, and I'm air quoting here, we're looking for a check. We're looking to get disabled so that we can sit on the beach with a Mai Tai. And I will tell you, the DOD actually, or the Department of Veterans Affairs actually paid for a study. I have the results of that. They paid for a study because they were just convinced that there was a huge fraud going on in the claims process. And the study came back and found out that less than 1% of the people applying for benefits with the Department of Veterans Affairs were fraudulent. Less than 1%. That carries through to the medical care as well. When you have people coming in and going, I'm sick, I have all these weird things wrong with me.
Right.
You know, help me, please. I just want to feel better, or I want this to stop.
Right.
And you go through, let's see, here, we'll try this, and you can't move forward to the next space in line until you've done this treatment for 6 months or for 9 months or what have you. And then with some of these diseases, you don't have that kind of time. And it's one of the valuable things that we found with the civilian providers is they do have enough interest in it. They are willing to listen, and they're not willing to discount or dismiss when you sit down with this laundry list of weird, bizarre symptoms, seemingly all unrelated. They're the ones that are going to sit there and go, oh my gosh, we need to start digging deeper. I'm going to be very upfront and fully transparent. I do not utilize the Department of Veterans Affairs for healthcare. I have not done so in 7 years because they told me they refused to care for my lung condition. They refused to provide me care. And I am rated. I'm 100% disabled. But when the doctor, a specialist, refused to care for me, the option was pretty simple. It was either suck that up and probably have been dead by now, because my civilian providers were very hard at keeping me alive.
How easy is it to find experts like Dr. Miller at Vanderbilt, but that would be accessible to veterans who may be living in any part of the country, any part of the United States that might have constrictive bronchiolitis and maybe need help in diagnosis and whatever treatment that can be done? What are you hearing from veterans around the country on that issue, getting access?
Well, the biggest thing we get is people reaching out. And I literally just this afternoon, someone reached out to us, and they found our website. And most people just, you know, they start with Google or their social media accounts and things like this. So they'll start digging through those and or find a news article, and they'll back search through that. What I will tell you is that because we've managed to get enough discussion and very public discussion about this now, there are several other researchers that are willing to step forward now, that have come forward and are willing to help or help provide more research and background information. We have a network. We've amassed in 10 years this massive network, and we reach out for, you know, if I have people in California that need to get to see Dr. Miller, like, as an example, there are organizations that help with travel. There are organizations that will help with either paying for the bill, or, you know, some providers will actually waive the bills, knowing full well that these people aren't going to get care if they don't. And this community, this very sub-community of this, you know, this is just a microcosm community of veterans networks. And as we continue to talk about this and we continue to push this out to the very front, because it's not just the burn pits. And as you guys got to see, I sent you over, we had a conference last month, and what we discovered, because quite by accident, just like everybody else, I got on and was doing some research about this, and I discovered that there's a very large organization, very well structured and been around for a very long time, called Ceasefire Campaign. And Ceasefire Campaign, their purpose has been to get the DOD to stop using open air burn pits. Wow, that seems like okay, we're redundant here. Nope, actually not. I reached out to them, and as it turns out, their sole mission is to stop the Department of Defense from using open air burning of toxic things here inside the U.S. and
United States, but not overseas.
Right. Wow. They were only focusing on, and they still do, they're very, very busy. Their focus is all in CONUS, and these are not, by and large, these are not just garbage dumps. These are not just trash dumps. Most of these are like waste munitions plants, things like this, stuff that is very toxic.
Right.
And if you or I wanted to, and it's my favorite analogy because pretty much everybody in the country knows this. If you or I wanted to burn a tire in our backyard, we could go to jail for that. That's actually a criminal offense in most jurisdictions, because the chemical that is emitted when a tire is burned, called butadiene, and it is deadly. And if you are in an enclosed, even in a building, if it's burnt in the basement and you're on the third floor, you will still die from it.
Wow.
That's how toxic it is.
Was this group that you were able to reach out to, have they been of any help, you know, as far as maybe their research that can be transferred?
They've actually been working really hard, and they managed to get the Department of Defense to the table, and one particular location, Holston, Tennessee, there's a waste munitions plant there where they've been open-air burning for decades and just poisoning everybody. Well, the Ceasefire managed to get a congressionally mandated research done by the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine to study exactly how toxic it was, what was being emitted out of the Holston facility. And DOD agreed that whatever, we call them just the NES, whatever NES said, they would agree with, because they were confident that they weren't killing everybody. And lo and behold, the NES came out with a report, which we have available, that they were, that they are poisoning everything around them. And they have now agreed, as of November of last year, they agreed under a consent order to cease open-air burning. Now, the part that's really annoying is that under EPA law, they're actually not allowed to open-air burn. And specifically, DOD is not allowed to burn.
So
they
how
were
they
granted
away
an
with
exemption. Well, because they were granted an exemption that was a really short-term exemption. And Congress and courts have all said this exemption was, and I'm talking back in the 70s, the exemption was supposed to be very short-term to allow them the time to build in the capital expenditures to start using alternative methods. Now, Ceasefire and other organizations have had them, the DOD, in and out of court for decades now over this, all over the country. Right here in Florida, we have several sites right here in Florida where they're doing it. And each time the DOD comes out and screams and yells that they have this exemption, well, they were just told again. That exemption was a short-term exemption. It was not meant to be permanent. And by the way, you now don't have an excuse, because the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine also came out with identifying all of the alternative methods available to dispose of waste, especially toxic waste. And all but, like, I mean, quite literally a handful, like less than five things in the world all have alternative methods that won't contaminate everything around them. And that report was given to the Department of Defense and was actually presented again at our conference. And it's a huge topic of discussion at the moment, because the Department of Defense on May 19th issued a statement to Congress And I'm actually going to read...
Is that the open burn pit report that you had sent me?
Yeah, well, no, this was actually the, on the 29th, the Federation of American Scientists put out an article or a statement, the Department of Defense continues to rely on open pit burning for waste disposal in some of its contingency operations abroad. Specifically, DOD identified a total of 9 locations where they're being used. And mind you, that list of 9 locations is not inclusive of ones that we have already confirmed that are in Iraq and Qatar. Doesn't also discuss the ones in the U.S. But here is the DOD's justification. By way of justification, the DOD report said that in countries such as Iraq, Syria, or Afghanistan, it is common practice to burn waste in open pits. I'm going to tell you what we have told everyone else that read this. That is the most childish and sanctimonious statement I have ever heard. Because other countries, third world nations that don't have running water in their buildings, because they do it, it's okay for us to do it. That is the DOD's justification. And I remind people that 10 years ago, much beleaguered former General Petraeus put out a statement quite similar to this, that due to the investments are focused on providing a more lethal force by investment of costly support systems, trying to say that it would cost them too much money to use these alternative methods. That song didn't work 10 years ago, but they're trying to replay it again, when in fact, the National Academy of Science already put out, here's the list of the things you can use, and it won't cost you as much as what you're doing. And saying that it's okay to do this.
Let me ask you about the one, because there's at least one in Afghanistan. We've been in Afghanistan, we meaning the United States, since late 2001. So we're going on, you know, this fall will be 18 years in Afghanistan. We have a smaller presence in terms of our force compared to earlier years, but they're still using an open-air burn pit in Afghanistan, apparently. Is that correct, according to this report?
According to this report, and here's the icing on the cake, that in 2009, one of the tasks, and I appreciate you going through kind of my CV at the beginning of this show, because one of the tasks I had working for Defense Logistics Agency just prior to my medical retiring was to handle all of the incinerators being purchased. From the very inception of the RFIs, identifying the contractors, sourcing everything out, right down to the absolute getting them on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've had incinerators on the ground in Afghanistan since 2009. In 2015, the Special Investigator for Afghan Reconstruction, basically like the OIG, went through all of Afghanistan, and the report in full color pictures is scathing. The DOD was refusing to use the incinerators. They were citing operational security because apparently running an incinerator 12 hours a day was a bigger red flag to the Taliban than having a giant glowing open-air pit burning 24 hours a day. It was easier to, yeah. That I'm telling you, this was absolutely what they did. They said these things. It was, then they also said that they didn't have people trained to operate them. They actually came with manuals. We made sure of that. And we had, in the contracts, we had, the contractors were sending people on ground to not only install them and set them up, but to train everyone that was going to be running them. And it's not hard. Put stuff in, close the door, turn it on, watch it burn. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not brain surgery.
So we're talking
about
large,
10 years later.
Lauren, we're talking about large installations, not maybe small field units or locations, correct?
Yeah, no, we're talking about things that will, pardon me, the as an example, the ones we sent to Iraq in 2009 were enough, were sufficient to handle the waste product byproducts that were all of the Victory Base complex and
which
all the manpower living there.
Thousands of people. This was like
right.
a small city, right?
It was like a large city.
Large city, okay.
It was bigger than Tampa, yeah.
Okay, all right.
And that's the idea of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
this
so
was not...
Not...
Yeah, this wasn't some little backyard thing we were sending over. And we're talking right. trillions and trillions of dollars. And the ground commanders in Iraq, when we were getting them into Iraq, we had ground commanders that were turning them away and saying, well, you know, the president, the former president, had said, we're shutting down. You know, we're going to pull out of Iraq, so we're going to send these on to Afghanistan. So they never even brought them into Iraq, not intentionally. And the ones that did land there actually never got set up. But we're having the same argument now with them, and they're trying to use the exact same statements, and one of which, but I am insulted for Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan just by the statement that they made. I'm insulted for them because we know that those are war-torn countries that have literally spent decades having their country blown apart. They don't have infrastructure. They don't have plumbing. They don't have sewage systems. They don't have an electrical grid. And the Department of Defense is comparing us being there to them. To we can all operate the same way. No, we lead from the front. Our nation leads from the front. We do not walk in and say, oh, and not to be offensive, but there's a method of doing bodily functions that some of the Iraqis did that there's no way in the world that any of us are ever going to do that in this country. So their statement and their argument is completely without any validation. This is an insult to every American.
Now, on a side note, though, it's also surprising that they issue this report about open burn pits that are still being used, and there's seven of them in Syria. It might surprise the American public to know that we have enough troops in Syria that there would be, installations or posts, locations, where they've got seven open-air burn pits going. I mean, they're being more focused on the fact that I think there's probably a lot of
ding, ding, ding! You win the chicken dinner.
Yeah, there's a lot
of
unaware.
Oh, by the way, yeah.
Troops there. So.
Last year, almost exactly a year ago, one of our local military reporters, he's now moved on to bigger and better things. He was basically attached to CENTCOM. That's all he ever did was CENTCOM. You know who I'm talking about.
Howard?
Yeah.
Okay.
We got pictures from a soldier stationed in Taji, Iraq. And those pictures were all date stamped. And all of them were from February of 17 through June of 17. Obviously, we weren't at liberty to release his name or his picture because the DOD would destroy his career. But these were pictures of the burn pit operating. I gave them to Howard, and Howard went to CENTCOM, and CENTCOM said then, oh, no, we're not, that's not our burn pit. Well, what is it then? What exactly is that if it's not a burn pit?
Yeah.
Well, according to the Department of Defense, now here's where we're all going to start talking about the reality of what's happening. The Department of Defense is walking around talking out of three different faces, because at that point, they told Howard that they only had two burn pits in operation worldwide. Two. And that was not one of them that we saw in Taji. 6 months later, they announced through a media source, which it was a reputable one, through McClatchy, that they had nine. And none were in Iraq. And now we have this list, and yet I have firsthand information that we have one in Qatar that is so bad, that the leadership of the base have moved their family either onto the other side of the base where they're away from it or completely sent them home, that they're refusing to allow the juniors, their families, to leave. Basically, suck it up, Buttercup. And
wow.
I brought that to the congressman's attention last week when I met with them. That family is actually, we're handling that very sensitively because that person is still there. And the family is deathly afraid of what's going on, that they know that these people are being moved out and being allowed to leave. Well, why isn't everybody being removed? Or why don't we shut the pit down? There's the big option.
Right.
Every time the DOD has been questioned, either they don't show up, they've done that twice, or when they do show up, the stuff coming out is not, first off, it's not verifiable because, you know, operational security. Okay. Operational security, my hind leg. If you're going to have open air burning, guess what? NASA takes pictures of everything now. We have those. And we do. We now have a source that is getting us the pictures from NASA.
Especially at an installation that apparently must be permanent enough where they have family members there accompanying them, right? Am I missing something?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're talking Qatar. It is definitely what's called a soft cap base. It's not a war zone.
Yeah.
Why are we using an open air burn pit in Qatar?
Right.
Oh, yeah. Because they do it too.
Yeah. Well.
You know, offline, I'll tell you what they actually do.
Part of the world that's not acceptable by our standards, and our troops are going to pay the price. Lauren, just in the interest of time, if we could, why don't we talk about the legislation that is addressing the open burn pit issue and the injuries and disabilities that veterans are suffering. What can you tell us about any pending legislation and legislation that your group supports?
Well, we have, right now, our group, organization is part of a very large task force that was set up by another organization. One of the big six set it up and invited anybody that wanted to be part of it. It was one of the first times that we've ever seen a welcoming with open arms, and it's to anybody that was interested in being part of this. And it's a toxic exposure working group. And what we're doing is the first thing we did was try to get our handle on how much legislation is out there. Well, of course, at the moment, there's 9 bills that have already been filed. And there are several more floating through their cracks. Most of what we're seeing at the moment are palliative bills. And we say that because these are bills that will make a segment of the population feel better. They'll make their heart warm. They won't fix
any of the
problems.
But not do much? Is that what the hidden message
yeah,
is?
Okay. Right. Well, and we're not even hiding it. Palliative care does not cure any symptom. All it does is make you feel better. Well, that's what's happening. We have several bills that want to add things to the registry or add people or allow other people or what, you know, pick a thing. The problem is there's not a single bill that fixes the registry. 2 years ago, NAS was actually part of the statute to make the registry. They were tasked with doing an assessment of the efficacy of the registry. And it's mind-numbing that 9 pages of recommendations, and the most glaring one is telling the VA, please go hire a third-party civilian organization to fix it. It is so broken and so unusable. We cannot even pull enough data out of it to identify all the people that served at this one location or something. The data is useless. It's a gaping black hole in cyberspace.
I see.
And the VA knows it. And I had a conversation with the secretary's office the first week in April, and I specifically asked, with all these things that are coming down the pike, you know, we have a lot of bills that are saying we're going to add deceased veterans to the registry. We're going to add, you know, if someone's on the registry and then they pass away, we want to be able to go in and edit that. All these things, what are you doing to fix, you know, to go with the recommendations and make the corrections? Nothing. We're not doing anything. So I had a conversation with Congressman Bill LaRocca's office about that. I said, and here's my conjecture is that if they're not going to fix the registry, then it's never going to be useful. They're pushing out propaganda saying that, you know, you're helping other veterans by registering on there. No, you're not, because no one can use the data. So they're completely fabricating information that they know isn't true. Congressman Bilirakis is, they told me they were going to be sending a letter to the secretary specifically asking, you were given this recommendations 2 years ago. What have you done to date? What is your way forward on this? What is the timeline on getting these things done so that this will be operational? So we're waiting back. That was last Tuesday I met with them, and I'm assuming that, you know, sometime in the recent past, that letter's gone out.
So, Lauren, let me just ask you this. So the registry that the VA has out there and has for a while, they've known for at least 2 years, if not longer, that it's basically flawed, that the information is not complete enough, it's not usable. And so, and two years plus have passed, and that registry is still a mess, basically. Is that right? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly, and they know it.
Yeah, so let's... So hopefully there's some legislation, but that should give us pause here about here's the database that the VA purports to be relying on to study veteran illnesses associated with burn pits, and the registry is a mess. What about other legislation? You mentioned nine bills. What about the issue? Have you seen or any progress on legislation that might create a presumptive list like we have with Agent Orange, where if a veteran served near a known burn pit and developed one of a list of conditions like constrictive bronchiolitis but other certain cancers, that are that they will presume service connection, so the veteran doesn't have to go out there and find an expert to make that connection. Any progress on that?
Congressman Bilirakis, we worked for 10 years, it took us to build that bill. Last July, Congressman Bilirakis submitted, it then was numbered H.R. 6582, Protections for Veterans Exposed to Burn Pits. Mm-hmm. It's the most unique piece of legislation ever to discuss any type of toxic exposure in two things. One, when we went through this, we did not want to give the VA the opportunity to say no to everybody and drag them through another 50 years of court.
Right.
So we had to look at also, because the VA is notorious for saying, here's the one little map dot where we're going to grant you presumptive. So if you had boots on ground in that little tiny, you know, 1 square mile map dot, you're good. If you served 1 inch outside of it, no way.
Right.
Well, we also know that because we're talking about the use of open-air pits and the things that have been identified that went into those pits and still do, obviously, the different chemicals, every single chemical has a noxious reaction to humans, but then you also have when they're incinerated or when they're combined with other chemicals and they're incinerated, they turn into different things. Like dioxin is not an organic chemical. It's one that is created when other chemicals are mixed together. And we decided to take that instead. We're going to take that track. We're going to take the known research that exists, and I'm talking 50 years of EPA, OSHA, you know, take alphabet soup.
Right.
All of them have their own data on all the chemicals. We have all the DOD reports showing what chemicals were there. I mean, going back to 01, we know what was there, what is there, what's been burned. And all we have to do is then draw the line from this chemical, butadiene, to pancreatic cancer, whatever the diseases that it crop up from those chemicals.
And
that's how the list is going to get created.
And that this stuff should be based on research that EPA, OSHA, et cetera, that's been their area of expertise for, like you say, for 40 plus years, right?
Right. Well, and also the DOD actually bases all of their regulations, including their environmental regs, on EPA regulations and law.
So any progress?
They can't argue much about it.
You mentioned this bill was H.R., I think, 6582. Any progress on that? Do you see any movement in
the
House?
What we have is it died with the last Congress. It has to be resubmitted. With the new Congress, we obviously, you know, the power, it got shuffled. And it is now, when I talked to them last Tuesday, the final hurdle was we wanted an independent committee to take those agencies' research and create the list of diseases. And both the minority and the majority side said, hey, that's going to be really expensive. What if we give it to the National Academy of Science and ask them to do it? If we change that to that, will you guys be happy? And we're like, sure. Because I actually got that call the night before our conference when Dr. Butler, who's the head of that section of the NAS, was speaking at our conference. And he gave me the huge thumbs up. They're more than happy to do it.
That's kind of like what
anything.
It's kind of like what they did with Agent Orange. It sounds like. Well, Lauren, we're about running out of time here. Before we go, can you share with our listeners again your website and where they can go for more information, if they can donate to help your group, those kinds of things.
Our website is veteranwarriorsadvocacy.com. We also have a presence on Facebook. We have a public page there. You can contact us. You can donate through there. You can donate through our website. We have two separate private groups. Both are closed to VA employees for the protection of our members. But anyone can join. They do have to answer some rudimentary questions. Both of the groups are accessible through our public page, and our public page is pretty easy to find on Facebook. It's Vet Warriors One. And we encourage people to ask questions, and we encourage them to say, hey, I have this weird disease. Can you help me find the specialist? Because the list can never be complete. It will never be complete. As long as these things keep coming up, we just have to take the case and we move them to where they got to go.
Well, you've got a daunting challenge ahead, and we want to thank you, Lauren, for being on our show again, and thank you for all the great work you are doing for veterans, and invite you back again in the future whenever you're available to keep our listeners updated on your organization's projects, especially the open burn pit issue. I know there's so much, and I know it's complicated, but thank you, Lauren Price, for your time with us tonight.
Appreciate it, and Veteran Wars, we all appreciate the time that you've given us and the forum to make sure because that's our biggest goal, is to educate everybody.
And you've done a great job, so thanks so much, Lauren Price. And
good job, Lauren.
We'll be back again soon.
Thank you, gentlemen. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Well, Rick, that was great to hear the update from Lauren Price on the complex open burn pit issue. It sounds like she's done just an incredible amount of research with her group, a lot of contacts. So, again, our listeners, their website is Veteran Warriors Advocacy. They're also on Facebook. So we're about running out of time here tonight. Rick, would you care to do the...
Let me close it out with the coaching and the care information, which is a very important program to veterans and their families. It helps It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life to return to home life. You know, returning home for a veteran can be extremely difficult, and the adjustment to civilian life is very, very difficult. We see it all the time in our representation of veterans. And this is not just tough on veterans, but it's also tough on the loved ones. So the Coaching and the Care program offers free coaching to help the veteran. So your loved ones, if you want to get involved, please, you call Coaching and the Care. The toll-free number is 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, the Coaching and the Care number is 1-888-823-7458. Also, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has the Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. We know the numbers about 22 suicides a day involving veterans, and probably more than that. And usually it's because they did not get the help that they needed through the VA. So help them get the care that they need to cope with their problems. Once again, that number is the Veterans Crisis Line, 1-800-273-8255, and press 1. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Rick. It's time for us to go. I'd like to thank our special guest tonight, Lauren Price of the group Veteran Warriors. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli and Corey and Hurley Law Group. And I'd like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Please tune in next week, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 Central, 5 Mountain, and 4 p.m. Pacific Time here on BBS Radio Station 1 for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, we hope you have a great week. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.